This episode of Court Junkie is sponsored by Everlywell. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, but now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of physician-reviewed private tests, from food sensitivity to metabolism to thyroid. No more sitting in waiting rooms or waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Everlywell, your test on your time and on your terms. This episode is also sponsored by Smokeball, a law practice management software company that you will absolutely love, especially if you work for a law firm. There are a lot of you legal eagles out there, so this one is especially for you. Smokeball is the only case management software that automatically records your time and activity for you, which is why the most profitable small law firms use Smokeball to stay organized, improve productivity, and increase profitability. Get daily digest updates, law firm insights reports, automatic Word to PDF creation, over 14,000 automated legal forms, dedicated account management, and much more. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive 50% off the onboarding fee when you sign up at Smokeball. Just visit smokeball.com/court to get started. That's smokeball.com/court to learn more and to schedule your free demo. And now, on to today's episode. Today's case involves a husband and wife who are both suspects in a brutal murder.
Under the scorching Texas sun, in water that's 89 degrees, there lies Laura Ackerson's torso. It's been split in half.
Both are blaming the other.
This case is about a man covering up his wife's actions. On July 13th, Amanda Hayes killed Laura Ackerson during a fight. It wasn't something that was planned, something that happened.
Amanda, did you kill Laura Ackerson?
No, sir, I did not.
Did you help Grant kill Laura Ackerson?
I absolutely did not.
Were you present when Grant killed Laura Ackerson?
No, sir, I was not.
But who was the real killer? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 55. On Monday, July 18th, 2011, Detective James Gwortney with the Kinston, North Carolina Police Department was given a missing persons report from his supervisor, who asked him to look into it. The report was made by a woman named Siobhan Mathis, who had called police after not being able to get in touch with her friend and business partner, 27-year-old Laura Ackerson. Detective Gwortney met with Siobhan, who told him that she had tried to reach Laura several times, but hadn't been able to get a hold of her since July 13th. She and Laura owned a marketing company called Fork and Spoon Marketing, and it was unusual for Laura to just fall out of contact. Siobhan told Detective Gwortney that she had called the apartment manager where Laura lived and asked her to go into Laura's apartment to see if she was there. She wasn't. Siobhan said she then asked the manager to retrieve any notebooks that were in Laura's apartment and give them to her. She handed Detective Gwortney the notebooks the manager had given her and told him that Laura kept meticulous notes about what she did during the day and that she had been going through a heated custody battle with the father of her two children, Grant Hayes. Laura and Grant, a local musician in Raleigh, had first met in March 2007. They started dating and eventually had two children together, two boys, ages 2 and 3. Laura thought that she and Grant were legally married, more on that a little later, but it wasn't long before the couple split up and a contentious custody battle ensued. After hurling accusations of everything from abuse to drug addictions at each other, Laura ended up losing custody, with only visitation on the weekends. But by all accounts, she had been trying all year to regain custody. Detective Gwortney noted that in one of the notebooks Siobhan passed over to him, Laura wrote down the appointments that she had scheduled, the last one being on July 12th, and nothing since. He stopped over at Laura's apartment and obtained surveillance video from the hallway outside Laura's door. She was last seen on that surveillance video leaving her apartment on July 13th at 8:10 a.m. She was wearing a sleeveless shirt, capri pants, and was carrying a duffel bag and a purse. Back at the Kinston Police Station, Detective Gortney had just gotten off the phone when another detective, Detective Whitaker, came over and said that she had heard him say the name Laura Ackerson. She told Detective Gortney that she was familiar with Laura, that she had a case with her and Grant Hayes in the past, a custody dispute, and that Grant had alleged that Laura had been abusing their kids. She told him that no charges were ever filed and that no evidence was ever presented. Detective Gortney decided to call Grant, so he called the number they had on file and left him a voicemail. Grant called him back a short time later. Detective Gortney told him that Laura had been reported missing and that he was trying to track her down. Grant said the last time he saw her was on Wednesday, July 13th. He said she came over at about 6:40 p.m. to pick up their two boys for a midweek visit. He said he had called her at about 3 p.m. that day and asked her about picking up the boys. She told him she was doing business in Wilson, but said she would come pick them up afterwards and take them to Monkey Joe's, a local play area and restaurant for children. He said Laura came over to their apartment and that his wife Amanda kept the kids in a separate room while he and Laura talked about their custody arrangement. He said they were going to discuss signing an agreement for Laura to keep the boys. Laura then left with the boys and returned with them between 9 and 9:30 p.m. He didn't think they went to Monkey Joe's, however, because he said the boys were sweaty and hadn't yet eaten. His wife Amanda had to take the kids to Chick-fil-A to eat. He said Laura left around 10 p.m. that night. A couple days later, on that following Friday, July 15th, he said he and Amanda were going out of town so he could meet her family in Texas. He said he was supposed to meet Laura at the Sheets gas station in Wilson, where they typically met, so she could take the boys for the weekend. But, he said, Laura never arrived. He said he left her some pretty nasty voicemails while he was waiting. After talking to Grant, Detective Gortney checked Laura's bank activity. There had been no transactions made since July 10th. Laura's car, a 2006 Ford Focus, was also missing, so a Be on the Lookout, or BOLO, was issued for both Laura and her car. 2 days after receiving the initial missing persons report, on Wednesday, July 20th, Laura's car was discovered at an apartment complex in Raleigh. It was pulled into a parking space with the wheels turned to the left. Investigators were unable to lift any fingerprints from the vehicle. It appeared to have been wiped down. There was no sign of Laura, but the location where the car was found was significant. Investigators would soon learn that the apartment complex was where Grant had once lived with Laura back when they were together. And not only that, but it was close to where Grant currently lived with his wife Amanda, too. Meanwhile, as detectives were examining Laura's car and tracking down her phone records, Grant and Amanda were busy leaving town. Detective Gortney looked into Laura's phone records and saw that the last phone call from her phone was at 4:59 p.m. on July 13th from Grant. And according to her phone's GPS, she was heading right towards Grant and Amanda's apartment. Detective Gortney met with detectives from the Raleigh Police Department and turned the case over to them. They then executed a search warrant at the Hayes apartment. Immediately upon entering the apartment, officers could smell bleach and noticed a large bleach stain on the living room carpet. There was also an indentation in the carpet from where a dresser had recently stood. They tracked Grant's phone to Richmond, Texas, and discovered that Amanda's sister, Karen Berry, lived there. And 2 days later, on July 24th, two detectives with the Raleigh Police Department headed out to that location. When they got to Karen's house, Karen and her two teenage sons were home. Grant and Amanda had come to stay with them a few days prior, but had headed back to Raleigh by the time detectives had arrived. One of the detectives asked Karen, "Is Laura here?" And Karen said that she was afraid that she was. She was very somber and seemed worried as she told the officers about Grant and Amanda's stay. She recounted a troubling conversation she had with them where they had told her that Laura had been hurt and hurt bad. They had also been inquiring about vacant properties and septic tanks. More officers arrived at the home and a search warrant was executed. They recovered coolers, a machete, and boxes of acid that had been dumped just down the road from Karen's house. Detectives learned that Grant and Amanda had shown up with coolers and furniture from their apartment and had taken Karen's boat out in Oyster Creek, the creek located right across from Karen's home. A local dive team came out and began searching the creek, and what they found was absolutely horrifying: the dismembered remains of Laura Ackerson. While Laura's remains were being recovered from the creek, back in Raleigh, Officer Kevin Crocker was tasked with locating Grant and Amanda Hayes. He went to Grant's parents' home and parked about a block away while he conducted covert surveillance with other officers in the area. Officer Crocker then observed Amanda's silver Dodge Durango pull up to the home at about 5:30 p.m. Amanda was driving with Grant in the passenger seat and three children in the back. They stayed in the vehicle for a couple minutes until Grant's parents pulled up. They all got out of their vehicles, and Amanda took the kids inside, while Grant removed a pink tote bag, several grocery bags, and two large coolers from the Durango and took them inside. He then came back out and parked the Durango in the backyard behind the gate, closing and locking the gate behind him. Later that night, homicide detectives arrived with a search warrant for the Durango and for Grant and Amanda's cell phones. While holed up inside his parents' home, and with officers still surveilling them from outside, Grant logged onto Facebook and started messaging some of his friends. Quote, "Neither Amanda nor myself have our phones right now. All I know is this thing with Laura is very serious. They trashed our house and took our car. Pray for us and pray for her too. I'm only talking to about four people, and we consider you dear friends." Later that day, he writes to another friend, "Y'all keep us in your prayers for real. They trashed our house, took our car and our phones. It's a bad movie, man." His friend responds, "You got it, brother. Damn, man, who the hell is they?" Grant writes, "The cops. I'm being investigated as far as I can tell. They said missing person, but the warrants said homicide. I need a good damn attorney if Laura don't turn up soon. They found her car across the street from our house, right where she and I used to live. Tell me that ain't fishy. This thing is real fucked up, Chris. It ain't a joke." The friend says he's been watching the news and gives him the name of an attorney. Later that night, Grant also messages someone named Lainey and says, "Laura showing up and doing anything right now would be the best thing ever. I'm being investigated as far as I can tell. You know a good attorney in Raleigh who might take a high-profile case pro bono? If Laura don't show up soon, I may be in for the fight of my life and I'm really scared. Black guy, white girl, custody fight? WTF, this whole thing is top news story here. My picture, her picture, court papers, it's a nightmare." The next morning, on July 24th at 9:41 a.m., he messages another friend. "Did Laura ever say anything to you about running off, leaving town, or wanting a new life? Did she ever mention to you a name or a place? We really need to help the cops find her." And then, just one day later, Raleigh police moved in and arrested Grant and Amanda at his parents' home. Even though Grant and Amanda Hayes were both arrested and charged with Laura's murder, there were still plenty of questions surrounding Laura's death. Grant was tried first. And going into his trial, we know that Laura was murdered and dismembered, but what we don't know is who actually killed her. And that's because both Grant and Amanda were each blaming her murder on the other one. Grant was claiming that Amanda killed her during an argument and that he helped with the cover-up because he loved his wife and wanted to protect her. But Amanda was telling a very different story about Grant having been the murderer while claiming that she too was a victim of Grant's. It's a case of he said, she said, but what, if anything, does the evidence show? Grant's trial started on August 29, 2013. In their opening statements, Wake County Assistant District Attorney Baz Zellinger told the jury that Laura's head, torso, and leg were found on July 24, 2011, in a creek across the street from Amanda's sister's home in Richmond, Texas. He said the case is about hate that came from a custody dispute and said that Grant and Amanda wanted to obliterate Laura and didn't want her having any part in the lives of their two sons. He called the case so calculated, so malignant, and so destructive that Laura disappeared off the face of the earth for 11 days. And while police were looking for her, Grant, Amanda, Grant and Laura's two sons, and Grant and Amanda's baby daughter went to Texas with Laura's remains hidden in coolers. And while police were discovering Laura's car, abandoned in an apartment complex, Grant and Amanda were taking a boat trip with those very coolers. Zellinger said that hours after Grant invited Laura over, in the early morning hours of July 14th, he went to a local Walmart and purchased a plastic tarp, a reciprocating saw, and blades. When it was the defense's turn to give their opening statements, they blamed everything on Amanda. This case is about a man covering up his wife's actions, Grant's attorney, Will Durham, said. Amanda Hayes killed Laura Ackerson during a fight. It wasn't something that was planned. Durham told the jury that Amanda was extremely resentful of Laura. He said Laura had come over to Grant and Amanda's apartment for a midweek visit with her sons. During the visit, Grant and Laura agreed that he would get full custody in exchange for $25,000. He then left Amanda alone with Laura while he went to go get his sons. And then something happened. We don't know what, Durham said. He said Grant was afraid to call the police because no one would believe that Laura's death had been an accident. So instead, he made terrible decisions and went out and bought a saw and then helped dispose of Laura's body. Durham called it a horrible thing, but said it wasn't murder. The evidence will show that Grant is not guilty of murder, he said. The first witness for the state was Siobhan Mathis, Laura's business partner and friend, who first reported her missing. She testified that Laura had told her that she was afraid of Grant.
She told me that she didn't know what Grant was capable of, and that if anything ever happens to her, that he did it. Basically, she told me that she just feared for her life.
Siobhan said Laura's main priority at the time was her kids, and that she was trying hard to get them back. Another one of Laura's friends, Heidi Shoemaker, testified about Laura and Grant's relationship. She said Laura and Grant had problems from the very beginning, and that after the birth of their first child, Grant moved to the Virgin Islands for a gig. She said Laura told her that she wasn't going to go with him because she wanted to leave him. But Laura soon found out that she was pregnant with their second child, and so she ended up moving to the Virgin Islands after all. The family eventually moved back, and then Grant moved to New York for a record deal, coming back every few weeks to see Laura and the kids. But one time, Grant took their eldest son with him, telling Laura that he was going to do a diaper shoot commercial. But then he sent Laura a photo of him marrying another woman in Las Vegas. That woman was Amanda. She said it was then that Laura found out something pretty shocking about her relationship with Grant.
Laura looked at her marriage certificate and found no signature on it of Grant's. So she realized she was no longer his wife or never had been his wife. It was a shock to her.
The marriage certificate that she had received from the Justice of the Peace did not have a signature by the defendant.
That is what I was told, yes.
Heidi told the court that Laura and Grant's custody battle was so contentious that she had told Laura to keep a log of any contact she had with Grant and the boys. She said Laura did that, and even kept a log of what food the boys ate when they were with her, because she had been accused of them being sick or not eating certain things. As a result, Heidi said she kept a log of every activity she did with the children and every contact she had with Grant. Heidi said when she learned that Laura was missing, she told police that either Grant had her murdered or murdered her. She said that in the months before Laura's death, Laura told her that if anything ever happened to her, if she committed suicide, if she went missing or got into a car accident, to know that Grant did it. As for why Laura would ever go inside Grant's apartment, she could only think of one reason.
The only reason that I could think of would be that if he asked her to come because he was going to give her custody of the kids, it's the only reason I can think of that she would have gone.
She then described an incident with Laura and Grant from back in 2008. She said she was on the phone with Laura, who was pregnant with her first child, when she could hear Grant yelling at her and telling her not to talk to Heidi. She said she was worried, and so she went over to their house. When she got there, Grant was getting into his car, and Laura was crying with a bloody nose that looked like it had been broken. But Laura refused to go to the hospital or call police. She said Grant went off on both she and Laura and said, "I have friends. I'm powerful. My friends are powerful, and I can kill you." Then he said, "Don't fuck with me." Heidi said she later got a concealed carry permit and purchased a gun. Lolita Chapman, an agent with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, or SBI, said she assisted in the execution of the search warrant of Laura's apartment in Kinston. She said they found a laptop computer on Laura's desk and a journal on the table beside her bed. She skimmed through the entries and saw that Laura wrote about her issues with Grant. She said Laura was very detailed and recorded any interaction she had throughout the day. The last entry was July 12th. Chapman said she also went through Laura's phone records to see who had contacted her on the 13th. The last phone call was right before 5 p.m., and the number belonged to Grant. On cross-examination, the defense brought up a diary entry in which Laura had said that Amanda called her psycho crazy, and another where Laura confronted her about an outburst in front of her sons. On July 13th at 4:19 p.m., Laura made her last outgoing phone call and left her last voicemail. It was to a woman named Oksana Samarski, a relatively new friend of hers. On the voicemail, Laura told her that she could possibly meet up with her later, but that she was going to see her kids first. On cross-examination, Oksana detailed a messenger chat that she had with Laura the night before. Laura had told her that she had joined a group online of ladies in similar situations, and she said that hers was, quote, so good, comparatively. Shay Gadet, Amanda's daughter, testified next. She said she first met Grant in St. John, Virgin Islands, at an art store that she and Amanda owned. On Thursday, July 14th, 2011, the day after Grant said they last saw Laura, Shay said her mom called her at about 10 or 10:30 in the morning and asked her to come pick up Grant's boys. She took them to Monkey Joe's. At about 1 o'clock, Amanda called her and told her that they needed about 2 more hours. She said they were planning on moving to Kinston to Grant's parents' house, and they were trying to secure a moving truck. Shay said she finally brought the boys back around 5 p.m. When she got to their apartment, her mom asked if she could borrow a vacuum cleaner because theirs had broken. She said she wasn't happy about it because she was married, lived across town, and had already had the boys all day long, but she went and got her vacuum along with food for them. On that following Tuesday, Shay went to the apartment again. She said Grant and Amanda had a Craigslist ad listing to sell one of their couches and that someone was going to meet her there. She spoke with her mom, who told her that she and Grant were in Texas. She walked into the apartment and immediately smelled something bizarre.
I walked into the apartment, looked around. The apartment smelled like bleach. And I opened the back sliding glass door, the window in the boys' bedroom, the window in their bedroom, and there was a towel by the front door that smelled like that's where the bleach was coming from, so I put it in the linen closet on top of the washer.
Later, that Friday night, she spoke to her mom again, who told her that they wouldn't be moving after all, because Laura hadn't shown up to pick up the boys. Her mom quickly then ended the phone call, saying that Grant and the boys had just come in. After Grant and Amanda were arrested, Shay went back to their apartment to pick up the boys' belongings and bring them over to Grant's parents' house, where the kids were staying, when she noticed something about the hallway bathroom.
When I went to go and actually get their belongings, I realized that their bathroom that they normally use with all of their bath toys, and both boys were potty training at the time, so their potty chair was normally in that bathroom. The hallway bathroom had nothing in it.
When you say nothing in it, did it have a shower curtain?
No.
Have a shower liner?
No.
Have a shower rod that hangs on?
No.
To have a toilet seat cover?
No.
To have floor mats?
No.
She said she also found an owner's manual for a handheld electric saw. On cross-examination, Shay told the jury about an argument Amanda once had with Laura. She said Laura had called her one day and told her to stop raising her children, that Shay was not their mother. Shay said Amanda then called Laura and told her to never call her daughter again. We'll get into more testimony, including testimony about Grant and Amanda's behavior while in Texas, right after this quick break from our sponsors. So I have to tell you guys about my newest time-saving trick. I actually got my contact lens prescription renewed from my couch in under 5 minutes using an awesome new app called Simple Contacts. Simple Contacts lets you renew your prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from anywhere in minutes through an online self-guided vision test. Every test is designed and reviewed by doctors, so they are literally bringing the doctor's office right to your home. Think of how much time you save compared to making an appointment, getting to the eye doctor, taking time off, etc. Better yet, the contact lens prices are unbeatable. The vision test is only $20, and shipping is free. Just remember, this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it is extremely convenient for when it's time to order your new contacts. I couldn't believe how easy it was to use. When I first heard about it, I thought it would take a lot longer than it does. But you just download the app, take a quick vision and eye redness test, and within minutes, you're reordering your contact lenses. So easy. And best of all, my listeners get $30 off of their first Simple Contacts order, which, if you're a contacts wearer, you know that that is a fantastic deal. Just go to simplecontacts.com/junkie or enter the code junkie at checkout. Again, that's simplecontacts.com/junkie or just enter code junkie at checkout for $30 off your contacts. This episode is also sponsored by Lisa. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features 3 premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. And check this out. They still have this amazing deal going for you court junkies. Get $130 off and a free pillow when you go to lisa.com/junkie. That's LEESA.com/junkie. Now, Back to the Grant Hayes trial. Laura's older brother, Jason Ackerson, testified about the custody battle between Laura and Grant. He said Grant didn't like him, and that one day when Laura invited him over, he knocked on their door, and soon after, he heard raised voices from inside. He heard Grant say, "You don't need to be around him. He's a bad influence. I'm all you need." He said Laura was trying to calm him down. He stood outside for about 5 to 10 minutes, but eventually left. Laura called him back the next day and said that he wasn't allowed to come over anymore because Grant didn't like him.
Did your sister ever indicate to you that she was concerned for her safety?
Yes.
And do you recall when that was?
September 09.
Did you ever have a discussion with your sister about her moving in with you?
Yes.
Was that about that same time that she indicated she was concerned for her safety?
Yes.
Ultimately, did you and she decide not to do that? That is, for her not to move?
Yes, ma'am.
Shay Gaudette's husband, Matthew Gaudette, took the stand next. He said that on July 14th, Shay called him and was somewhat distraught. She told him that her mom had called and asked her to watch the boys. Shay had told her that she would be over after a while, but Amanda said, "No, I need you here now." Shay was caught off guard and had to rush over there in a hurry. She was upset at the way her mom was speaking to her. Later that afternoon, Shay called Matthew again and said that she had just dropped the kids off, but needed to borrow their vacuum to bring to her mom's because they needed it. He said that was fine. Matthew said at some point he became aware that there was a plan for Grant and Amanda to move to Kinston. On a Friday evening, Shay was on the phone with Amanda when Amanda asked if Matthew could install a trailer hitch for them. He said he was willing to do it, but they started asking a lot of questions about his capabilities to install the trailer, and it became uncomfortable for him. So he essentially told them that he had never tried to do it on that type of car before and to try rally hitch or U-Haul. He said Shay told him that they needed the trailer to help with their move. A detective with the Raleigh Police Department testified about a letter that was found on a countertop area in the Hayes' apartment. She said it appeared to have been written in two different hands.
It says, "I, Laura J. Ackerson, for the sum of $25,000, agree not to pursue custody of the two minor children, Grant and Gentle Hayes. I am not surrendering parental rights, but I do consent to leaving them in the sole custody of their father for now. Further, I agree to drop all pending litigation against their father in the Lenoir County Family Court."
She said the letter was signed Laura Ackerson. Detective Robert Latour Jr. with the Raleigh Police Department told the jury that he went to the Sheets gas station, where Grant had initially told police that he had waited for Laura to show up on Friday, July 15th, 2011, before telling them that Amanda had killed Laura. This was 2 days after Laura went missing. Surveillance video from the gas station was shown to the jury. Grant arrives at 4:29 p.m. with his and Laura's two little boys. He walks through the gas station a few times, purchases some items, talks on his cell phone, and then finally leaves at 5:47 p.m. His cell phone records show that he called Laura at 5:51 p.m. Detective Latour said that after speaking with Shay, Amanda's daughter, he contacted U-Haul to see if Grant had rented a U-Haul from them. He reviewed surveillance video and learned that Grant had come in on July 16th and had in fact rented one. He paid with his credit card and turned the trailer back in on July 20th in Katy, Texas. According to the U-Haul receipt, Grant had also purchased sofa covers, a lock, and 20 boxes. Latour noted that in the video, Grant doesn't appear scared or nervous, nor does it look like he's in any kind of a hurry. After tracking Grant's cell phone to Texas and learning that Amanda's sister Karen lived there, he and another detective drove to Karen's house and met with local Fort Bend County police officers. Karen and her two teenage sons, Shelton and Dalton, were also home. They spoke with Karen and her sons and then walked around the property. Latour said there were coolers laying around, a lot of trash piles in the backyard, and a suitcase and dresser on the front porch. Latour interviewed Karen and her sons at the police station. It was during these interviews that the missing persons case turned into a homicide case, after dive teams reported that they had found remains in the creek across the street from Karen's home. When Latour got back to the property, he walked over to the creek and saw a tarp set up on the side of the creek where dive team searchers were gathering the remains. After finding a Home Depot receipt on Karen's property, Latour went to the local Home Depot and checked the surveillance video. Sure enough, at 10:20 a.m. on July 19th, Grant walks up to the cashier with a full shopping cart, a 32-gallon trash can on top, four boxes of muriatic acid, and gloves underneath it. Grant paid $80 in cash. On cross-examination, Latour said that when he showed up at Karen Berry's house, she didn't seem surprised that he was there. But he said at no time did he consider Karen a suspect or a possible accessory. Karen's son, Shelton, testified for the prosecution next. He said he lived with his mom, dad, and brother Dalton in Richmond, Texas in July 2011. He recounted how detectives came to their home after Grant and Amanda had come and stayed with them. He said his mom had told him that Grant and Amanda would be coming to stay with them only a few days prior to them arriving. It was very short notice, he said. He typically left for work anywhere between 6:30 and 8 a.m., and one morning in July, he woke up and Grant and Amanda were there. They had driven a silver SUV and a U-Haul trailer. Grant's two sons and their newborn baby girl were with them. He said he had never met Grant before that morning. One night, on that Tuesday, he came home from work and had a few beers with Grant in the driveway.
Did you have any discussions with him while it was just the two of you out there drinking beer?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you recall what you discussed?
Different things, but asked me if alligators eat people, if hogs eat people, different things about hogs and fishing and the beach and things around that nature.
Shelton said when Grant asked if alligators eat people, he said that yes, they're alligators. Grant asked him where the alligators were at, and he told them that they were down the creek a ways. He also told him that pigs ate people too, that they're carnivores. He said he thought that Grant was asking because he was a city boy. They also talked about shark fishing. Grant told him that he wanted to catch some sharks to take back to his dad in North Carolina. He asked Shelton where the sharks were. On cross-examination, Shelton clarified that both Grant and Amanda had asked him to go alligator hunting, but that he didn't have time. Shelton's brother Dalton then took the stand next. He said while Grant and Amanda were staying with them, Grant had asked him how deep the creek was. He said he told him that in some places, it gets pretty deep. When Grant and Amanda were getting ready to leave, he said he saw Grant cleaning out the coolers they had brought. He said they looked like they were brand new, although one had a black mark in it. Grant left two of them there when they left. Dalton also recalled a conversation that he overheard Grant having on the phone.
Do you recall whether or not the defendant was on the phone during the time that he was at your house?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you recall about that?
When we were cleaning the coolers, he said something along the lines of, "I don't need an alibi, I was with my family." And he was on the phone a lot.
So the part of the conversation that you overheard, "I don't need an alibi, was with my family," that was during the process of packing up?
Yes, ma'am.
He said Grant and Amanda also left Amanda's suitcase behind because they said there wasn't enough room for that either. When asked about the furniture Grant and Amanda had brought, he said he offered to help them unload it from the U-Haul, but they said no. Later, they had unloaded it themselves and then left the items in their yard. There were three pieces of furniture. After Grant and Amanda had left them there, Dalton and his friend moved the items from the yard to the porch. Officer Kim Roskovich with the Fort Bend County Police Department was part of the body recovery team. She said she and her team recovered a torso that looked like it had been cut in half in Oyster Creek, along with the part of a leg. Detective Brad Richard with the Fort Bend County Sheriff's Office then testified about his role in the investigation. He first responded to Karen Berry's house on Sunday, July 24th, in the afternoon. He met with detectives at the scene who briefed him on the investigation thus far. He told the jury that at the end of Karen Street, about a mile and a half away, there was a wild game camera. When it detects motion, it takes a photograph. They recovered photographs from the camera and saw that on Wednesday, July 20th, at 9 a.m., 1 week after Laura went missing, Shelton Berry's truck comes into view. The truck pulls over and Amanda, who had been driving, gets out. She can then be seen dumping boxes of acid into the creek. Investigators collected the acid cartons from the side of the roadway. Detective Richard also testified that at the back of Karen's property was a hog pen, and he noticed discoloration on some of the dirt in there. In the yard, there were three piles, two piles set up to be burned, and one trash pile. On cross-examination, Detective Richard said that through their investigation, they also came across surveillance photos from different ATMs near Karen's house. On January 19th at 9:37 a.m., Amanda can be seen withdrawing money from an ATM close to the Home Depot. 45 minutes later, Grant is then seen on camera making the acid purchases. Amanda can then be seen dumping the acid the next day on July 20th. And about an hour after that, she's captured making a withdrawal at another ATM close by. Brian Anthony Davis, a member of the Houston Police Department dive team, recounted how he recovered a human head from Oyster Creek on July 25th as he and his team were conducting yet another search of the creek.
As you went through the lilies, did you make a discovery?
Yes, ma'am.
Describe that.
I found what initially I believe was a leg, and I called Mark over, my partner over, so we could start measurements and get photographs.
When you say initially you thought it was a leg, what about what you had discovered led you to believe it was a leg?
I could see a bone in the center of it, and it was cleanly cut. There was no hair on it. And then on the other side, it was decomposing. So I believed it to be the thigh initially.
Indicated that you called your partner over. Did at some point you determine that, in fact, it wasn't a leg?
Yes, ma'am. As I said, the lilies are pushing down on us, and I needed to get some help to get relief from them. Mark came over. We discovered that it was, in fact, the head and not the leg.
And how was it that you were able to tell that once he got over there that it was the head?
We were able to roll it over and just you could see that it was a face there.
An employee from Home Depot told the jury that he remembered Grant coming into the store in July 2011.
He told me he had an odor that he was trying to get rid of. And we talked about some of the products we have, and he told me that he was visiting relatives, and I think one of their sons had captured a wild hog and had it in a pen. And they had since released the wild hog, and he had volunteered to clean the pen. And I told him at that time that none of the odor removers that we sell at Home Depot would do that job. He said, well, no, he needed something to take care of that odor. Did we have any kind of an acid? And I said, well, we have muriatic acid, but that's not going to do the job. And he was pretty adamant about wanting to see the muriatic acid. So I finally took him outside, and I don't remember the quantity. I know we loaded several boxes into his basket. He purchased a trash can, which was right there by the muriatic acid, and I suggested that he buy some gloves.
He said Grant was insistent on getting the acid. Michael Galloway, a crime scene investigator with the City County Bureau of Investigation, or CCBI, tested Amanda's Dodge Durango for blood, but the tests came up negative, No blood was found in the vehicle. He said that on July 25th, he assisted in the search of Grant and Amanda's apartment. He noted indentation marks in the carpet in the living room, where a dresser used to be, and he said that the bathroom near the living room was practically empty. No shower curtain or rod, no carpets on the floor. He said the bathroom was clean, and although he checked for blood with Luminol and Blue Star, there was no blood found. There was also no blood found in the bedroom, bathroom, living room, foyer area, or on a mop that had been found on a balcony. He said parts of the carpet in the apartment appeared to have been bleached out. The state then called their expert witness pathologist to the stand, who testified that she could not determine the exact cause of Laura's death due to the remains being decomposed. However, she was able to conclude that it was homicide by undetermined means. She said that it was possible that Laura had been strangled or that stab wounds to her neck could have caused her death. Kevin Crocker with the fugitive squad at the Raleigh Police Department testified that he was tasked with going to Kinston and attempting to locate Grant and Amanda. He staked out Grant's parents' house, where he believed that they were staying upon their return from Texas. 2 days after search warrants were executed on Amanda's Durango and Grant and Amanda's phones, Crocker returned to the address to continue surveillance. He said that at the time, evidence kept turning up that made Grant and Amanda strong suspects, and he was to maintain surveillance until it was determined whether or not they were going to be charged. That night, on the 11 o'clock news, it was reported that Raleigh police had two people in custody, but that wasn't true. There still hadn't been any arrest warrants issued. Crocker was still surveilling their house. But the news seemed to have rattled Grant.
From my vantage point, I saw Mr. Hayes come out of the residence, and at that time he was smoking a lot of cigarettes back to back to back. He appeared to be very nervous. His parents kept coming out, and it appeared as though people were trying to console him and talk to him at that point in time.
That was after the 11 o'clock news had played or been broadcast.
Next up, the prosecution focused on some communications they found between Grant and Laura, and also between Grant and his friends. A detective with the Raleigh Police Department showed the jury various text messages between Grant and Laura. In messages sent months prior to her murder, Laura pleads with Grant to please respect that she is the boy's mother, that she will always be, and to respect the short intervals of time she gets with them. The last text messages between them were on July 13th, between 1:44 p.m. and 4:12 p.m., where Laura discusses having an appointment in Wilson before coming to pick up the boys. The detective testified that Laura's number does not appear in Grant's phone records from July 15th through July 22nd, a time she was reportedly missing. Another detective with the Raleigh Police Department, Zeke Morris, testified that he too assisted in the search of Grant's parents' house. He said Grant and Amanda had been taken into custody a couple hours prior to the search. He said he collected two blue coolers from a bedroom on the first floor, along with a notebook with a handwritten signed note. The note relinquished custody of Grant's sons and Grant and Amanda's one-month-old daughter to Grant's mother. It was dated July 24th, 2011, and read, "I, Grant Hayes, leave my children in the sole custody of Grant and Patsy Hayes." There were two pediatricians' phone numbers listed at the bottom, and it was signed by both Grant and Amanda. Detective Morris also looked into Grant's Facebook account and discovered that he had talked to many people about his struggles with Laura. On August 16th, 2010, a little less than a year before Laura's murder, Grant messages a friend and says that he is stressed from the whole custody arrangement and what it's doing to my boys. Their mom is a woman scorned and, well, making life for me as difficult as possible. In October 2010, Grant says to another friend that he's in a, quote, nasty custody battle with Laura's crazy ass. The following month, in November 2010, another friend asks him how Laura is doing. Grant responds, "Fuck Laura. We split up in the Virgin Islands. I'm surprised you remembered her name. No one else did. Figured out she was just using me. Sugar daddy Grant. She got two kids out of me, but I have both of them. She gets them on the weekends. In February 2011, Grant says to another friend, "I have them 5 days a week. She gets them on the weekends. We've been in court for a year. It's hard on everybody. She's just gold digging and thinks these kids are her ticket." In March of that year, he writes, "In May, my ex started a ridiculous custody dispute over our two sons. I mistakenly came down to North Carolina to answer the hearing, and the court ordered that I couldn't leave the state with my boys, even though I paid $40,000 to get into my place in New York City. Down the drain. Had to set up shop in Raleigh. Not really able to gig around here. We've just been living off of our savings. $85,000 in legal fees. Forensic evaluators, shrinks. All on me, of course. The good news is that the courts gave me primary custody of both boys in a temporary order, and I've had the boys for the last year. The bad news is I've gone from having the financial security to allow my wife and I to stay home all day to selling jewelry just to keep the lawyers on the case and the lights on." In May 2011, 2 months before Laura's murder, he tells another friend, "My ex Laura was crazy and I didn't know it till it was too late. We had two kids together and she's still putting me through hell. I've been married over a year to another woman and I still have to hear her voice every day. Just watch who you have kids with is all I'm saying." And then in a message dated July 12th, he writes to a friend named Mark, "We won't be there till late August. Got a court date for child support and shit. I'm just going to let Laura keep the boys. North Carolina ain't going to let me share custody unless I stay here, and I just can't make a living around here." Sergeant Brian Hall testified about additional purchases Grant made at Walmart shortly after Laura was murdered. On July 15th, he purchased 3 duffel bags and paid in cash. The next morning at 6:46 a.m., he went to Walmart again and returned the 3 bags. He then purchased a 120-quart cooler, a 75-quart cooler, and 3 bags of ice. On Friday, July 29th, Sergeant Hall said he met with the trash collector from Grant and Amanda's apartment complex. He testified that he was able to recover items from Grant and Amanda's apartment that had been thrown out, including several bags that had each contained 10 pounds of ice, face masks, yellow rubber gloves, protective goggles, a pair of women's pants, men's underwear, a red bleach-stained towel, and a yellow discarded vacuum cleaner. He also recovered floor mats, shower lining, and cleaning supplies. DNA evidence was entered into the trial next, from various DNA analysts with the North Carolina State Crime Lab. Laura's blood was found on latex gloves recovered from the trash from Grant and Amanda's apartment complex. A second set of DNA was also found on the gloves, but they were unable to conclude whether it came from Grant or Amanda. There was also the presence of blood found on a swab taken from the door frame in Grant and Amanda's apartment, a swab from a chain in the boat recovered at Karen Berry's house, and on a coffee can from inside the boat. There was no presence of blood found in the vacuum recovered from Grant and Amanda's trash. There were a number of other items tested, including roots of hair from the bathroom drain in Grant and Amanda's apartment, but no DNA profiles were able to be recovered. One analyst testified that using chemicals will destroy DNA, including using hydrochloric acid or muriatic acid. After the DNA evidence, the jury heard from Courtney Last, a computer expert, about emails, text messages, and voice recordings between Laura, Grant, and Amanda that had been saved on Laura's computer. An email exchange between Laura and Amanda from October 2010 went as follows. On October 24th, 2010, Laura wrote, "I would like to address the attitude you have towards me in front of my children, though. I understand that Grant has probably told you that I'm the worst person in the world, among whatever else was useful for him to say in the moment. But if you could please contain yourself in front of them, it would be appreciated. If you have something you would like to say to me, I totally understand and welcome it, just not when they are in earshot." 6 days later, on October 30th, 2010, Amanda responded, "I'm not too sure what you're talking about at all. If there were ill feelings over the exchange last Sunday, then they're not on this side of the family." Amanda then invited Laura to spend Thanksgiving with them. "I think the boys would enjoy that. What do you say? Holidays are important, and these memories will be in their photo album. They don't have to know that this was happening. On June 22, 2011, an email exchange between Laura and Grant started with Grant saying, in part, "Absolutely not. After what you pulled last week, you must be crazy. Why don't you listen back to those recordings you made when you learned how to act and stop creating drama? You are more than welcome, but you showed complete disrespect for everyone with that stuff you pulled. For one, you didn't even bother to read the email I sent you. You showed up late and delayed me another 15 minutes trying to confront me over some manufactured BS you used to cause a scene." Laura responded, "I record every situation you and I are in together because of your lies. That recorder has been in my pocket every time you've seen or heard me since way back. That's not me to a T. You can stretch the truth as much as you like. I've got everything recorded. Go ahead, build your story. You just give me the ability to prove that you're a liar. Thanks. Keep playing your chess game, Grant. Thank God the courts are involved and they see people like you every single day." Grant also sent two emails to Laura after her death. One was at 4:08 a.m. on July 15, 2011. He asked her if she wanted to keep the boys for a week. Then, later that day, he emailed again. "I mean, seriously, we're trying to reach a settlement and you go dark on me after agreeing to, shall I say, certain terms," he wrote. "Yes, real fucked up. I have nothing more to say to you until I hear from your attorney." Copies of the emails were also saved on Grant's computer in his email account in a folder that read, quote, "messages from a hoe." Last also testified that Laura referred to Grant as a sociopath and that she had actually reached out to a support group for victims of sociopaths. In an email to one group, she wrote, "I recently got out of a relationship with one, but we have two children together. I am wondering if you know of any resources for helping me get him diagnosed. My kids are at risk here, and I need all the help I can get." On cross-examination, Grant's attorneys pointed out that Grant didn't threaten Laura in any of the emails. Laura's attorney, John Sargent, said that the custody agreement between Grant and Laura was temporary and that a hearing was scheduled for August 15, 2011, to establish permanent custody. But Laura was killed just 1 month prior. He said that the year before, Grant had told the court that Laura was mentally unstable and was a danger to the boys, while Laura had said that Grant was a substance abuser. But since then, Laura had started going back to school, started her own business, and got her own apartment. He said that Laura was optimistic that she would at least get split custody, and for good reason. A forensic psychologist who had conducted a report on both Grant and Laura for the hearing had concluded in her report that Grant should have a, quote, "full psychological exam for his disturbed thinking." But even though Laura was optimistic, Sargent said that she was concerned about Grant's reaction. He said that in March 2011, he had a conversation with Laura where they decided that she would not put herself in a situation where she would be alone with Grant. On day 9 of Grant's trial, prosecutors called an inmate named Pablo Trinidad to the stand, who was serving 21 years in prison on drug charges. Pablo testified that Grant talked to him about the case and told him what had really happened.
He told me that she was an unfit mother. That they've been having a custody battle for some years now. Going back and forth, and that she was soliciting herself on the internet. She was doing drugs, that she continuously asked for money, and he was just tired of going back and forth with that. So he said that he pitched a call to her and lured her to his apartment, and that's when him and his wife subdued her and strangled her. Later on, after that, that's when they dismembered the body, and afterwards, they took her on a road trip and out of state, out of town, and got rid of the body.
He said Grant also talked to him about Amanda and told him that she was a good person, and he wished that she was the mother of all of his kids. Before the prosecution rested their case, they played for the jury a song that Grant Hayes had written and recorded called Broomstick Rider. Grant leaned back in his chair and nodded his head along to the beat as it played. Some of the lyrics include, "My baby's mama, don't talk to me, don't want your drama. I got two kids by you, I can't take any more from you." And, "I put a price tag on your head. You must have told your attorney. I got intentions on killing you." When it was the defense's turn to present their case, their first witness was Amanda's sister, Karen Berry. Karen said that the day after Grant and Amanda had arrived at her house, Amanda pulled her aside.
She came in and she told me that she had hurt Laura and that she had hurt her bad. And she needed to talk to me.
So that's how she indicated she needed to talk to you, that she had hurt Laura and she'd hurt her bad. Did y'all go somewhere more private?
I went outside to the swing.
What did she tell you at the swing, if you remember?
She asked me if Grant could come over with us. And I told her that he was her husband. If she wanted him to come over, that was up to her.
She said Amanda then called Grant over.
I know that they asked me if there was any property that had a big hole in it. And they wanted to know at some point if Grant wanted to know if the well had a big hole in it, and I told him, no, that's not that type of well. It doesn't have a big hole. And sometime during that time, I had told them that if this was bad, that it was my belief that if something was really, really bad, that it would be best to tell the truth, and that I knew an attorney that we could go talk to if they needed to go talk to an attorney.
Now, at that time, when you were talking about a hole, some property with a hole or the well, at that time, did you believe that Laura was alive or dead, or did you know?
I wasn't really thinking anything at the time. I wasn't really thinking anything.
Did Amanda tell you anything more about the circumstances of how she hurt Laura? Did she describe that, of what happened?
No, sir.
She said she didn't ask how bad Laura was hurt because she didn't know what was going on, that she was in shock. She said she brought up that there was a septic tank in the back, and she said as she was going to show them, she realized that something was really wrong. And she told Amanda that it wasn't a good idea. She said she doesn't remember what they talked about after that. Karen said she didn't know what was in the U-Haul and didn't ask. She assumed that it was a piece of furniture. That's what Amanda had told her previously on the phone, that she was going to give it to Karen because it had been in storage. Grant's attorney asked her if at some point she figured out what was going on.
I can't say I put two and two together. I had suspicions that something was wrong, and I'm not sure how to answer that because I really just don't know what my feelings were. I really don't know what they were.
Okay. But at some point, did you come to the conclusion, at least in your head, that Laura was dead?
I think so. I think so. I did.
She said that Grant and Amanda took her boat out on Tuesday night. Her daughter Candace had arrived at that time, and Karen thought it was strange that they had decided to take the boat out then because Candace had come over just to see Amanda. After they left, she said she spoke to Amanda once on the phone and for a short period. She said she heard Laura was missing from either her children or from Amanda's daughter, Shay. It then was all over the news. Detectives came to her house on the following Sunday morning, on July 24th. She said she wasn't really surprised to see them and that she answered all of their questions. Karen then revealed a possible motive for Amanda possibly wanting to have hurt Laura.
Why she
said that Laura had told her that she had taken Laura's, and I don't know if she said babies or kids or boys, I don't know the exact words, but she had taken her kids and that she was going to take hers away from her.
And that she being, Laura said she's going to take Amanda's.
Yes.
You don't understand that to be baby, Lillian?
Yes.
Karen said it wasn't easy for her to tell the police what Amanda had told her and that she never wanted to have to testify against her. In their closing arguments, both the prosecution and the defense reiterated their versions of what happened. The prosecution said that Grant lured Laura to their apartment on July 13, 2011, and that he murdered her, cut up her body, and then dumped it in the creek near Amanda's sister's home. While the defense claimed that it was Amanda who had gotten into a physical altercation with Laura and had killed her. They even pointed out that she had allegedly confessed to her sister, according to Karen Berry's testimony. When it came time for the jury of four men and eight women to deliberate and decide which version they believed, it didn't take them long, less than 2 hours total. They sided with the prosecution and found Grant guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. Amanda went to trial just months later, facing her own charges of murder and accessory after the fact to murder. And in this trial, we'll get to hear what Amanda says happened the night of July 13, 2011. In their opening statements, prosecutors told the jury that Amanda had confessed to the crime to her sister, saying that she had told her that she had hurt Laura bad. Prosecutor Boz Zellinger said that Amanda resented Laura so much that she treated her like she didn't exist, and that Laura had written about her troubles with Amanda in her diary. But Amanda's attorney, Johnny Gaskins, told the jurors that Amanda often tried to play peacekeeper between Grant and Laura and didn't even know about the murder until several days later. He said Amanda was a victim of Grant's too, and that he had threatened her and he forced her to help him dispose of Laura's body. He described a volatile relationship between Grant and Amanda and said that Grant controlled her. They married in April 2010 after meeting in the Virgin Islands. Amanda was an actress and a widow who had money. She also owned an art shop with her daughter, while Grant worked as a musician. By the end of that year, Gaskin said, Grant had full control of Amanda's money and used it to travel around playing gigs while he left Amanda at home. He said Grant had isolated Amanda and that by July 2011, by the time of Laura's death, she was broke. Their money was gone. He said Grant killed Laura and afterwards he threatened Amanda and the lives of the children if she didn't help him dispose of Laura's remains. He conceded that Amanda helped him, but only did so under duress. And as for the confession to her sister Karen, Gaskin said that she also did that under the direction of Grant. Lolita Chapman, an agent with the FBI, who also testified at Grant's trial, read through Laura's diary entries, where she details her struggles with Amanda. On August 23rd, 2010, Laura writes, "She told me that she was responsible for my kids now because I'm psycho crazy. I'm certain that Grant has given her the scenario that I'm wacko and that he needs her to help him protect the kids from me." A month later, on September 23rd, 2010, Laura writes, "Grant has gotten Amanda so worked up towards me that instead of now giving me a report on the kids, she looks at me with disdain." Shay Gadet, Amanda's daughter, testified this time around too. Her testimony was pretty much the same as it was at Grant's trial, but one addition was a phone call she had with her mother on July 16, 2011. She said Amanda told her that she and Grant were going to Texas to visit Karen, and Shay told her that she would like to go too and see her aunt and cousins. She said Amanda got mad and told her that she had just lost her mother and had just had a baby and needed her big sister. She told Shay not to be selfish. Shay also testified that about a month prior to Laura's death, Amanda talked about leaving Grant, but also said that she felt trapped with no money. Karen Berry, Amanda's sister, testified again as well, and her recollection of her conversation with Amanda seemed to be a bit clearer.
She told me that Laura was dead and that she had done it.
But she also recalled asking Amanda before they left if she was covering for Grant. She said Amanda nodded her head yes. She said that when detectives first came to her house, before she spoke with them, she asked if she could pray. Sergeant Brian Hall testified that Amanda and her one-month-old daughter went to Chick-fil-A on July 13th, just after 9 p.m. She ordered two kids' meals and two adult meals and then stayed there for 30 minutes before leaving. And then Amanda herself took the stand, recalling how she met Grant as a single mom, having been previously married three times. And then she told the jury what she says happened the night of July 13th. Amanda said that she, the boys, and her newborn daughter were in the bedroom watching a movie when Grant came in and told her that Laura was there and that he wanted to talk to her about keeping the boys. At some point, she said she had to change the baby's diaper, so she left the room. She said she saw Grant and Laura sitting at the dining room table, and Laura was writing something, and then she slid the piece of paper over to Grant. Amanda looked over Grant's shoulder and saw that it was a letter stating that Grant would pay Laura $25,000 to give up the custody fight. She said she got upset because they didn't have any money. They were broke and were even about to be evicted from their apartment. She said she was upset at both of them. She then described what happened next.
And I was reading it, and Grant got up and walked to the kitchen, and Laura kept commenting how pretty Lily was, and I just turned around and walked off, and she had asked if she could hold Lily, and I just ignored her and walked off. And at that time, she told me to wait a minute, and she said that something to the effect that I had her kids, and I wouldn't even let her see my baby. And she approached me, and at that time, that she tripped over the rug and kind of bumped into me. I was heading to the nursery, which is, I know you guys have all seen the layout. There's was a love seat right there and a rocking chair right next to each other, and there's a little wall. And whenever she tripped over the rug, she bumped into me, and Grant approached her and grabbed her and kind of pulling her back and just telling her to chill out. And she started fighting him. And whenever she did, that little wall, but right by the love seat, she kicked it. And whenever she did, they both went over the chair and landed on the floor. And I just ran to the bedroom with Lily. I didn't even stick around to see what happened.
She said she quickly left and went back to the kids in the bedroom. She said about 5 minutes passed, and then Grant came into the room. He told her that Laura was hurt and that he needed to call an ambulance. He instructed her to take the boys out of the house so that they wouldn't see anything. She said she was really freaked out and was shaking. Monkey Joe's was closed at this point, so she went to a gas station, bought them a slushie, and she got herself a pack of cigarettes. She went through the Wendy's drive-thru and got a soda for herself. She then drove around for a little while and was a, quote, chain-smoking maniac. She then went home, but before she could unload the kids from the car, one of the boys told her that he was hungry and wanted chicken. She noticed that Laura's car was still at the house, but she figured that no one was home, that Grant had probably gone in the ambulance with Laura to the hospital. She took the kids to Chick-fil-A, ordered the family food, and then let the kids play in the play area for a while. When she got home, Grant was upstairs on the couch and the house was smoky. She could tell that Grant had been smoking in the house. She put the boys to bed and then sat down with Grant, who told her that Laura was fine, that she had just hit her head and then had left. She went to bed and she said she heard Grant leave a few times in the middle of the night, but she didn't think anything of it. When she got up the next morning, Grant wasn't there. She called Shay and asked her to come take the boys, and then she tried to call Laura to see if she wanted to talk to the boys. There was no answer, so she left a message. Grant came home at almost 11 a.m., just a few minutes before Shay came. Her attorney asked her about the hallway bathroom, and she said she believed that the door was closed and she didn't go in it at all that day. That was normally the boys' bathroom. That afternoon, she said Grant told her to tell Shay to keep the boys a little bit longer. She noticed that one of their large rugs was gone, and Grant told her that he had thrown it away because it was dirty, which wasn't unusual for him. She later went to Target to pick up snacks for the kids, and Grant called her and asked her to pick up some bleach and a pair of gloves so he could clean the bathroom, and so she did. Later, Grant asked her if she wanted to go see her sister, and she said yes. The three of them were supposed to just go, but Grant told her that Laura never showed up to pick up the boys on that Friday, so they all went. They got a U-Haul so they could fit everything, including a piece of furniture Amanda said that she was going to give to her sister. She insisted that she was not aware that Laura's body was in the trailer. She said everything was normal when they first got to Karen's, but later that night, after they all went to bed, she woke up and saw Grant walking around outside, so she went out there. They sat on the tailgate of Shelton's truck and started talking.
He told me that he was trying to figure some stuff out. And I asked him, like, what? And I'll never forget it. He was smoking a cigarette and he was like really calm. And he looked at me and he said, what would you say if I told you Laura was dead? And I was like, what? And basically, he told me that the night that Laura had come over to the house, that she had died, and that whenever I left, that he just panicked and freaked out. And I started freaking out, and I was asking him why he didn't call the cops, call for help, like he told me he was going to. And he told me that he got scared that he was a black man with a dead white woman, and nobody was going to believe him that it was an accident. And that he had taken her to Kinston. And then he stopped himself and he told me that he shouldn't be telling me any of that stuff. And then he had told me that the Kinston police called. And so I assumed that that they found Laura's body, since he told me that he took her to Kinston. And anyway, I was freaking out, and he had the machete and he whacked me on the leg and he told me to shut the F up and that this was not the time for me to start challenging him. And that he told me that I didn't understand, because I said something about the cops finding her, and he said, no, I didn't understand. And he told me that that I had to help him figure out how to get rid of this body, or else none of us were making it back to North Carolina, to Raleigh. And then he told me, he said, well, we're going to need your sister's help. And I said, I don't trust my sister like that. And he told me, he said, well, you better figure out how to make her trust, to trust you. And so basically he told me that the best thing that he could think of was that I needed to tell her that I was the one that pushed Laura, and so that she would help, because she certainly wasn't going to help him, because he was a black guy and this was the first time she had ever met him, and I better figure out how to make my sister help us.
She said she was really scared, and he told her that if she didn't figure it out, she would never see Shay again. The next morning, she said she told Karen that she needed to talk to her. Grant was within earshot.
I told her that Laura had come over to our house, and that she and I got into an argument, and that she had threatened to take Lily away from me, and that I shoved her, and that she fell, and that she was hurt really bad. I don't really recall saying that she was dead, just because I was afraid to say it. But somehow or another, I asked, Grant's watching us, and I could tell he was wanting to come over. So I asked her if it was okay. And so he comes over, and then, this is another thing. Whenever he and I were out there that night, he told me that it was my fault that this had happened. If I would have just let her hold the baby, that none of this would have happened. And so whenever I was talking to my sister, I remember I kept telling her that it was my fault, and I was crying, and she kept telling me that, I wouldn't be in this if it wasn't for him, and he wouldn't be in this if it wasn't for me, that, we were in this together at this point. And anyway, at that point, I'm just trying to help ask her to, if she could help us figure out what to do at this time. And she did ask if I wanted an attorney, and I told her no. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I was just trying to help him.
She said Grant decided that they needed acid, so she withdrew money and Grant purchased the acid. She said she was so scared and that Grant kept threatening her. They went out in Karen's boat, but Amanda said she didn't see anything. She said she was facing away from him, and it was dark out.
I just kept trying to keep the boat in the center, and I was scared there were animals, and it was dark, and the moon was... And I could just hear animals, and there was grass everywhere, and I just didn't know what was in the water. I was very scared. I didn't see anything. I just kept that way, and... It was taking a really long time. It seemed like forever and ever and ever. And finally, we started heading back that direction. We turned the boat around. I don't even know how long we were gone. And I was scared that we couldn't find where the boat went again. And as soon as we got to the dock, he told me to give me my clothes. And so I still had my shorts on underneath, and I gave him my clothes. And I asked him if it was okay if I went to the kids, and he told me yes. And as soon as I walked in, my sister had to go. And then he came, I don't know how long it was, and he came back. And he had some trash and stuff. Whenever my sister got there, he asked me to ask her for directions to an apartment. And so he had some trash he needed to throw out. And so he put everything in the back of the truck. I don't know what everything is. I didn't see it. I just know he had some trash bags or something. And I drove him to the apartments, and he threw everything away, and he asked me for my shoes. He took my shoes away from me, and he threw them away. And then we went back to my sister's house, and...
She said later that night, Grant started cleaning everything, and he told her that she needed to get rid of the acid. The next morning, she said she went to Walmart to pick up some snacks for the kids, and so she decided to just dump the acid at the side of the road. She said she didn't even know what it had been used for. She described Grant's demeanor during their trip to Texas and then on their way back to Raleigh.
Well, from Monday, the time he told me, he started just progressively getting a little crazier. Like whenever we were going to throw the trash out, like he was really kind of starting to get paranoid. By the time we started heading back to Raleigh, he was really, really very paranoid. He had the machete with him the most of the time. And I knew that he had that other little knife with him because he carried it all the time to the club. And whenever we got back to North Carolina, once we hit the state line, he was just really crazy. He was wearing one of the kids' hat, and he was wearing sunglasses. He wouldn't get out anywhere. He was really very scary. And I pretty much spent the entire trip back just praying for God to please keep us safe. I was just really scared. He really wasn't letting me talk to Shay. I know at one time, I can't remember if she called or he called, but she wanted to talk to me, and he told her it was against his better judgment, but he was going to let her talk to me for a minute. And Shay was just really mad. She felt like I wasn't telling her what was going on, but I couldn't tell her anything. I was just trying to protect her the best I could and keep her out of it.
She recounted how on the drive back to Raleigh, Grant wanted her C-section medication.
Whenever we got back to close to Kinston, we ended up getting a hotel room. And Grant had asked me where the medicine was that from my C-section, and I told him I had left it at my sister's. And he had gotten mad at me because he told me that we could have all just gone to sleep. And so, and another time, whenever we were driving, Lily was crying, and he told me if I didn't shut her up, he was going to throw her out the car.
She said he even threatened to slit her throat if she told anyone what happened. For their rebuttal, the prosecution presented additional witnesses who disputed some of Laura's claims. The first was an inmate named Patricia Barakat, who had spent some time with Amanda in jail prior to trial. Patricia told the court that Amanda had told her that she and Grant hated Laura, that Laura didn't care for the kids, and that she was only using them to extort money from Grant. Patricia said that Amanda also confessed to being in the room when Laura died, but said that it had been an accident and that it wasn't supposed to happen like that. Not once did Amanda ever say she was afraid of Grant, and in fact, told Patricia that she loved him. The prosecution's second witness was Detective Jerry Falk, who testified that Amanda and Grant had acted like newlyweds and were lovey-dovey with each other when they were initially arrested. The jury was also shown letters that Amanda had written to Grant's mother from jail. In one of the letters, she wrote, "Please tell my husband that I love him very much and I think of him every day." Another one was a note she wrote specifically to Grant that she had asked his mom to pass along. It read, "Hello, my baby. I love you so much and I hope you are doing good. Please take good care of yourself. I miss everything about you and can't wait to give you a big hug and kiss." The jury of 3 men and 9 women found Amanda guilty of second-degree murder, and she was sentenced to 13 to 16 years in prison. Judge Stevens made some closing comments, saying that based on the evidence, it's quite possible and likely that Amanda could have saved Laura's life, and she chose not to. Instead, she participated. Amanda then apologized to the court, quote, "I would just like to apologize with my whole heart, being, and soul, personally to Laura. I apologize to her, to her family, to her children, to my family, to Grant's family, to everyone who had to work on this case, to everyone who had to sit through this trial. I am truly, truly sorry with every ounce of my soul." Amanda has since filed for divorce, which was granted in October 2014. In April 2016, she was extradited to Texas to face a felony charge of tampering with physical evidence / human corpse. She could face an additional 2 to 20 years for that charge. Prosecutor Boz Zellinger told reporters that Grant wouldn't be facing that charge since he is already serving life in prison. And speaking of Grant, since his trial, he has reportedly incurred 5 infractions, including trying to escape. And that's all for this episode. As always, I want to know what you think about this case. First of all, what do you think really happened to Laura Ackerson on the night of July 13th, 2011? Do you think both Grant and Amanda are equally responsible? Or do you believe one over the other? And how does that affect the way you feel about their respective punishments? You can let me know by joining my Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I also want to say a special thank you to Jane Lee for helping me out with the research and the trial watching of this episode. And now, I have an announcement concerning my schedule for the next few weeks and months. As many of you know, I'm currently 8 months pregnant as I'm recording this, which means I'll be taking a maternity leave after the next episode comes out on June 25th. I'm planning on taking about 8 weeks off, with my next episode after that coming out on August 20th. But I do have a few case update episodes that I will be releasing in that meantime, so I won't be going completely dark on you. If you're a Patreon supporter, I'll be pausing your payments for the months of July and August. But first, I have one more regular episode coming out this month on June 25th. I want to thank everyone for your patience and your support. And thank you, as always, for listening. Until next time.